The Second Crusade has failed, but its end will open the door to the Plantagenets, that brilliant, avaricious, rebellious, murderous family that will dominate the history of Western Europe for a century to come. Here's their story, so riveting that we still are fascinated by it 900 years later.
Welcome back to Lion's Forge. My name is Beckett, and I want to tell you a story. An epic, true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 2, Episode 18, Passing Glory. By the year of our Lord 1182, the Great Revolt had slipped into history, if not from memory. Most certainly the memory of Eleanor of Aquitaine, Queen of England, Duchess of Normandy and the Aquitaine, Countess of Anjou, and prisoner of her unforgiving husband. For the past 8 years, she had been immured in Wiltshire, at Sarum, where the sky ruled supreme over the earth. There was no word as to when she might come home. She might never come home. Life among the other Plantagenets had been uncharacteristically quiet. With little else to do, young Henry, the family's eldest son, devoted his energies to the world of tournaments. If you were a young aristocrat, you simply had to be at the tournaments, following the sport across France. The latest rankings must have been a major topic of conversation, since there was a tournament somewhere almost every week. Even Henry Plantagenet, while grumbling at the cost, was proud of his oldest son's numerous victories, for if young Henry was on a short leash at home, he was a hero on the tournament circuit. Perhaps if we could live just one day from the time, we'd choose it to be a tournament day, even though the 12th century version known to young Henry wasn't what we've seen in movies. The 1100s were not the era when young champions rode their silk-draped war horses into one-on-one contests while lovely maidens watched. These early tournaments, an accepted way to let men burn off more energy than polite society had a need for, were primitive rough and tumble, literal mini-battles involving teams of knights, sometimes even organized infantry. There were occasions when hundreds of fighters participated in ferocious competitions across acres of ground, including entire towns. Casual observers, particularly females, were roundly discouraged. More than a few tournaments were fought with real weapons rather than blunted ones, and there was nothing in the rules to prevent a group from attacking an individual, since there weren't many rules. For example, it was perfectly acceptable for a team to hang back, riding in late in the day when everyone else was dead with exhaustion. Aside from war itself, this was the most testosterone-driven sport since the days of the gladiators. You could be hurt. You could be captured, stripped of your horse and armor, and obliged to pay a ransom to return to your pre-tournament life with your pre-tournament possessions. Winning knights were the sports superstars of their day, enriched by prize money, admitted to an international network of admiring contacts, glorified, lionized, imitated, drawn with delight into many a lady's inner chamber. The best of them all in the 1180s were young Henry, Count Philip of Flanders, and William Marshall. We haven't seen Marshall for a while. Marshall the legend, a 6'2" exemplar of the supreme qualities of the feudal world, courage and strength, skill at arms, loyalty to his lord, polished gentility in society, absolute commitment to personal honor. We first met him, if you recall, some 15 years ago, when he survived the ambush that killed his uncle when the Lusignans tried to kidnap Eleanor. Marshall, then in his early 20s, was credited with bringing down half a dozen armored horsemen in the vicious fight, so impressing Eleanor that she ransomed him from Lusignan captivity and brought him into her family, where he became a Plantagenet intimate. If his courage seemed almost supernatural, he came by it honestly. During the Anarchy, when William had been little more than 5, his own father had given him up as a hostage, famously remarking that if the boy were killed, Papa had a wife, and thus the hammer and the anvil to simply create another son. Spared by sympathetic King Stephen, Marshall went on to become the greatest fighter of his day, so powerful in his prime that people said he could carry an armored knight. Even at the age of 75, it was readily believed that he was capable of killing someone half his age in hand-to-hand combat. Legend says that he was undefeated in a tournament career lasting more than a decade. One summer season, he captured 103 opponents. After one melee, Marshall's helmet was so savagely battered, a blacksmith had to figure out how to shear it away from his head. Henry Plantagenet appointed the fabulous Marshall to head young Henry's household in 1170, when Marshall was 24, his charge 16. By the 1180s, Marshall and his protege shared the topmost rung on the tournament ladder. In real life, the prince might have been deprived of a real kingdom, but his snarling lion insignia ruled the world of tournaments. Bertrand de Born, the great troubadour who would be consigned to Dante's hell thanks to his influence on Henry Plantagenet's rebellious son, rhapsodized that young Henry was the greatest champion to live since the time of the French hero Roland, even if the world was searched as far as the River Nile and the setting sun. When Philip Augustus's coronation was celebrated with a splendid tournament at Lagny-sur-Marne, young Henry arrived with what chroniclers, famous overestimators when blinded by glory, said were 500 knights, a highly improbable number. Nevertheless, young Henry kept the group housed, fed, horsed, and armored at what we think was the incredible cost of 200 gold coins each and every day. It marked the absolute height of this would-be king's son. The prince's life was always a mix of immense good fortune and galling restraints. Things began to sour for him in 1182. Rumors began to circulate that his wife, the French Princess Marguerite, had been caught out sleeping with William Marshall. The princess was in trouble as it was, unable to give young Henry a living heir. Gossip had it that she'd be set aside soon, a more nubile princess put in her place. The unhappy prince was additionally chafed by his impotence in part of his inheritance, Normandy. Not only did he want what his younger brothers had, the ability to rule a country, but he needed the tax revenue, given his grandiose lifestyle which regrettably joined vast expense with limited income. His father would buy peace with an increased allowance, but a few extra gold coins never soothed young Henry's passion to seize enough territory to make himself a real king. Despite a truly glittering Christmas court that year, a breathtaking assembly of what were said to be more than 1,000 knights summoned to attend Henry, the old man's control over his fractious son was fading. Mere weeks later, young Henry took advantage of a possible anti-Richard insurrection. All the murmurings of Aquitanian lords who felt themselves oppressed by Richard's bull-necked determination to control them. Brother Geoffrey and Philip Augustus joined in, backing young Henry. The savage little war they made was fought across the Limousin, Richard's territory, rugged, isolated country made up by the foothills of the immense mountainous plateau called the Massif Central. Flecked with beautiful rivers like the Dordogne and the Creuse, covered with forests and upland pastures. The Limousin was a wild place, pocked with extinct volcanoes, and inhabited mainly by farmers, shepherds, and monks. Abbes took the brunt of young Henry's aggression. He needed food and money for his army, and monasteries were a good place to get both. Still, raiding churches to underwrite the cost of war should have given pause. Prince Eustace, he of unlamented anarchy memory, had sat down to dinner and dropped dead with his plate in his hand after rampaging through Bury St. Edmunds. Young Henry chose to disregard this warning from history. With brother Geoffrey lending support, the prince stole what he wanted at swordpoint from horrified abbots, including beautifully worked golden altarpieces gifted by his own father in happier days. One story says that he even had the effrontery to make off with an irreplaceable relic, the Durandal, a war sword everyone believed was once owned by Hector, a legendary champion of the Trojan War. In light of such crazed sacrilege, the inevitable. Prince Henry, only 28 years old, died. He came down with dysentery and never recovered, lasting at most a week of mortifying decline. Like great men before him, he would come to lay his weakened, naked body on a stone floor, humbling himself before a crucifix. One report said that his penitential behavior extended to laying his head on a stone pillow in his painful last days, a noose knotted around his neck. He sent messengers to beg his father to forgive him once again. In one of the many sad stories of medieval royalty, Henry Plantagenet would not come to his son's deathbed, fearing deception, possibly even ambush and assassination. Instead, he sent a ring that had once been on the finger of young Henry's great-grandfather, Henry Beauclerk. The prince gripped it as he died on a summer's afternoon in the year of our Lord, 1183. There's a poignant legend that his father the king said with weary anguish, "He cost me much, but I wish he had lived to cost me more." Young Henry was deeply mourned by people who had loved his looks and charm, his generosity and happy nature. As historian Matthew Strickland says, because he had not had to govern, to tax, to wage war, or to disappoint men by his judgments, everyone adored young Henry. Bertrand de Born, his longtime friend, wrote elegant lines of sorrowful loss.
"Now, every grief and woe and bitterness, the sum of tears that this sad century has shed, seem meager against the death of the young king. Prowess mourns, youth stands sorrowful. No man rejoices in these bitter days. All pride in battle, skill in song and rhyme, must yield to sorrow's humble threnody, for cruel death, that mortal warrior, has harshly taken from us the best of knights. Beside him, charity itself was mean, and in him every noble virtue shone."
In his somber final hours, the prince had told his household that he wanted his heart and entrails to be buried at the Abbey of Charolles, while the rest of his body, embalmed in salt, was to rest at Rouen Cathedral. Charolles is nothing but ruins now, but in its day, it was one of the greatest Benedictine monasteries, while Rouen Cathedral was one of the lovely new churches in the sunlit style of Sugère. The funeral cortege, headed by William Marshall, reconciled too late with his friend, made its way north toward Normandy. Some say the open bier was carried on men's shoulders rather than laid in a mere cart. Sadly, it was not a dignified trip. The funeral cortege was set upon by anxious mercenaries from young Henry's army, determined to square their wages before the prince's always scarce money ran out. Marshall apparently had to sign the equivalent of a personal guarantee, to the tune of 100 pieces of silver, to pay off some of young Henry's mercenaries. There are stories that the pallbearers were so destitute that they had to beg for food along the way. Worshipful but disorderly crowds were everywhere. Excited stories proliferated of lepers cured by touching young Henry's shroud, of a beam of unearthly light protecting his corpse. One legend holds that mourners following along with the funeral march were so pestilential in their devotions that the bishop in Le Mans refused to allow passage, arbitrarily ordering the corpse buried in his cathedral. Another story says that the locals of Le Mans simply refused to let it go after it had rested overnight in their city. Eleanor quickly pushed for his canonization from her prison, writing the Pope with lists of miracles attributed to her dead son. Certainly the only Plantagenet with saintly miracles to his credit. While the Plantagenets grappled with their primary heir's entirely unexpected death, Philip Augustus of France suddenly made a surprise decision of his own. He set his war with Flanders aside long enough to announce his intent to divorce Queen Isabel, news that would have startled half a dozen royal courts. No chronicles explain it. It was true that no son had yet been born of his 4-year marriage, but his wife was only 14, the king 19. She also was admittedly saddled with her uncle Philip, the original cheerleader for the marriage, who was making war on the crown. Given the relentless opposition to the lady from the other wing of the king's extended family, Isabel was contributing nothing to her husband's happiness. Isabel, however, was no delicate maiden. 14 years old or not, she was entirely determined to avoid losing husband, crown, and country. According to the stories, she got herself to the old city of Senlis, where her husband had sprung his awful surprise, dressed herself in penitential rags, and wandered the walled streets barefoot and in tears, handing out alms and imploring people to beseech the king for mercy on her behalf. Whether touched by her devotion, embarrassed by her public begging, or talked into a conciliatory mood by advisors, Philip gave up his pursuit of a divorce, and Isabel did go on to produce a son, the essential heir to the French throne. He would go on to become King Louis VIII, but reigned for just 3 years before dying in 1226 at the age of 39. As for poor Isabel, before her 20th birthday, she died following the birth of twins, who died with her. Medieval motherhood, medieval infancy, were supreme life struggles, and even royalty couldn't always win. As for Philip, once he had decided to keep Isabel, he pulled his wife's family even closer to the royal Capetian bosom. He appointed Isabel's father, Count Baldwin of Hainaut, the royal guarantor of the latest truce between the Flemish and the French. This made life most difficult for Baldwin. After all, just days before this honor was arbitrarily conferred upon him, he had been seen as firmly on the side of the Flemish. The infuriated Flemish, who thought the man a turncoat, attacked Baldwin's little kingdom, while Philip sat back and watched the Flemish coalition, not to mention his father-in-law, disintegrate. Such was the very young monarch who had succeeded Louis Capet on the French throne. Meanwhile, the old monarch on the English throne faced the unpleasant reality that young Henry's death had created thorny problems in terms of the inheritances of his 3 remaining sons. Richard was now the eldest. He held Aquitaine through his mother. By rights, he believed he now should get young Henry's portion too, which consisted of England, Normandy, and Anjou, leaving the status quo of Brittany to Geoffrey and Ireland to John. His younger brothers were less than pleased by this proposal. The king, in turn, as usual, had his own undesirable plan, which most implausibly called for Richard to take his dead brother's inheritance, but in turn to hand the Aquitaine to young John, still the least endowed of the Plantagenet sons. Perhaps Henry had decided, over his long reign, that the Aquitaine was a poor fit with his other more tractable holdings in Normandy, England, and Anjou. Or maybe Henry just disliked the idea of one son holding all the territory, all the wealth, and all the power that would become Richard's, especially in light of his heir's propensity for violent outbursts. Whatever his rationale, even a casual observer could promptly assess the limited probability this paternal proposal would work. The denouement didn't take long. Richard, who loved the Aquitaine as much as his mother did, outright refused, promising to launch an entirely new family war. Another pressing problem was the fate of the Vexin, that little buffer state so beloved by French and English kings. The old French half had come to the Plantagenets through the hasty wedding of young Henry to Marguerite of France when they both were small children. Young Henry was dead. There were no living children. The lady's dowry should now revert to her, which meant that Henry would have to watch that coveted bit of countryside end up back in the hands of the delighted Capets. To stave off that awful prospect, Henry made abject concessions. Provided the Vexin remained in Plantagenet control, he was prepared to do a great deal. He did formal homage to Philip Augustus for the Plantagenet's French lands. He settled a pension on widowed Princess Marguerite, who, by the way, would go on to marry the rich and powerful King of Hungary. And if the Capets might see their way to simply transferring Marguerite's dowry to her sister Elise, Richard's bride-to-be, Henry promised that the long-delayed Plantagenet-Capet wedding would soon take place. If not between Elise and her ever-absent fiancé Richard, then between Elise and John, no matter that John was betrothed to the Gloucester heiress. Apparently reassured as to Elise's future, Philip Augustus agreed, leaving his half-sister to continue life as an unmarried Plantagenet dependent, renewing all the gossip that Henry refused to let her go because she often graced his bed. Henry Plantagenet was 50 years old by now, beginning to tire, shorn of his eldest son, mired in squabbles among the other three. Short-tempered, short of new ideas, he laid strategy and diplomacy aside in favor of aggression. But it wasn't the clever, focused aggression of his youth. He actually urged his favorite living son, 16-year-old John, to take an army on the offensive against battle-hardened Richard to seize control of the Aquitaine. John in turn begged help from brother Geoffrey. Richard, now re-allied with Philip Augustus, handily whipped them both. The sheer embarrassment of the mess finally forced Henry to call a halt. Everyone was assembled back in England, even Eleanor, temporarily released after more than a decade in captivity. Henry's solution to the newest fight was a sorry one. He put Geoffrey in charge of prized Normandy, with the absurd proviso that Geoffrey was to acquiesce to Richard's hands-on management. It was an arrangement that wouldn't last 6 months. Nonetheless, for the moment, brothers supposedly reconciled with brothers, and sons with their father, no matter how tepidly. Husband tolerated unaccustomed presence of wife. Husband escaped unaccustomed presence of wife, some saying that he impregnated a married Welsh princess on his way out of town. The newest bastard's name would be Morgan, an old Welsh name having to do with the sea. Perhaps the baby's mother thought of the name as she watched Henry sail away. The old man promptly took himself out of range of the endless troubles of his embattled family. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again August 5th for the next episode of Lion's Forge, available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.